Today on the 21st, a Rock Island County man is out of prison this week after 13 years. The Illinois Innocence Project secured his release, saying he falsely confessed to murdering his own son, a crime he says he did not commit. But the case is not yet over. We'll talk to his lawyers. Then, Illinois-based Quaker Oats is ending its Aunt Jemima brand, saying it was based on a racial stereotype. Meanwhile, others are working to preserve the legacy of the real-life Chicago woman on whom the character was based. Plus, some Illinois farmers are changing their practices in an effort to protect our state insect, the monarch butterfly. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. 12 years ago, a man in Rock Island County pleaded guilty to murdering his own son. Nathaniel Onsred was sentenced to 60 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections, but this week, 13 years after the child's death, Nathaniel Onsred walked out of Menard Correctional Center. That's thanks to the work of the Illinois Innocence Project, which is part of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the University of Illinois Springfield. Joining us to talk about the case is Lauren Kaysberg. She's Chicago Legal Director for the Illinois Innocence Project. Lauren, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And Michael Oppenheimer, who's from the civil rights and criminal defense law firm of Erickson and Oppenheimer, who also worked on the case. Michael, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And as ever, we invite our listeners to join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Lauren, can you take us back to 2007 to begin? Who was Dax and what happened to him?
Yeah, you know, we've really been celebrating the fact that Nate was able to be released and walk free, but this is a bittersweet victory because, you know, what happened in 2007 was that a four-month-old baby tragically died. So Dax was born 10 weeks premature and suffered from some very serious medical complications and ultimately died because of those medical complications. And when Dax became unresponsive and ultimately died, he had been in the care of his dad, Nate, who did everything he could to save him, but it was too late. And these medical complications just overtook this baby. And so at that point, the police, you know, got involved as they would with the death of a baby, and it sort of took on a life of its own from there.
And the death, Lauren, initially was not ruled as a homicide, right? The forensic pathologist did not. It took some persuading, I guess. How would you characterize that? What changed there?
Yeah, I think persuading is a good word. Initial reviews by medical professionals looking at this death and at the autopsy records showed no signs at all of foul play. And it was very clear from the beginning that this was a medical-related death. And it was only after other forensic pathologists were brought in and that law enforcement and detectives were involved, that they sort of came up with their own theory based on some hunches that they had that maybe Nate had something to do with this. They completely changed what the science showed and formulated a case around Nate having been involved in his son's tragic death.
So, Michael, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Nate's interactions with the law enforcement in Rock Island County. How did that go for him?
Sure. And I would agree with everything Lauren just said. But, you know, basically what happened here was the coroner from Rock Island County and the police department decided that, you know, they couldn't just allow an accidental death to occur, as tragic as it is. And they had to blame someone. They blamed Nate. So what, through the good work of the Innocence Project and working with us, we hired an outside pathologist, Dr. Michael Bodden, out of New York, and his preliminary findings, which are not done yet, were that this is an accident. And what happened was the coroner and the police department decided to conspire with a Cook County medical examiner at the time to get her to change her ruling from accidental death to homicide. Once that happened, they decided that they needed a statement from Nate in order to perfect their case and to prove him guilty, because they really had no evidence whatsoever that he was guilty of a murder, because it wasn't a murder. So what they did was they interrogated him over a long period of hours. And the interrogation, like many of these coerced confessions, takes advantage of Nate's educational level, the fact that he was remorseful and not remorseful, the fact that he was despondent over the death of his only child. So they took advantage of that, and they basically coerced a confession. Combining that confession with the medical examiner's new ruling that it was a homicide, they then tendered that to his public defender. And based on what the public defender had, she convinced Nate to plead guilty to murder. What we've learned later is, and the investigation is ongoing, is that thousands of documents, maybe up to thousands of documents, were never turned over from the state's attorney's office to Nate's lawyer at the time. And that kind of sealed his fate.
You know, Michael, you're, a criminal defense and civil rights attorney by trade. Why would somebody plead guilty to something if they didn't do it?
Well, I'm a former prosecutor too, and then I became a criminal defense attorney, and now for the last 15 years, we do primarily civil rights. What we're learning and what's happened is, for years and years and years, no one would believe that someone would confess to something they didn't do. And that's simply not true. What the police department does is they simply coerce people, and it doesn't have to be by a physical beating or anything like that. It's psychological torture. They use the fact that he was despondent over the child's death. He had no attorney with him. It's just like in the movies and on TV where they say, don't talk unless your attorney's with you. That's absolutely true. So he not only wanted to please the investigators, they used his sadness and his grief over the death of his child to make him feel guilty. And to say things like, maybe I pushed him down too hard, maybe I set him down too hard, maybe I did this, maybe I did that, and even worse. So people tend to say things because there's promises that they can go home. There's promises that if they don't say it, that they'll spend the rest of their life in prison. There's all sorts of things that the police departments do sometimes to convince people to plead guilty when they really didn't do it. And we're seeing that all across the country for many, many years. And the Innocence Project has done great work. But that's why they're in existence, because people do confess to things they didn't do. And that's what happened here.
So, Lauren, and I should remind our listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Lauren Caseberg, who's the Chicago legal director of the Illinois Innocence Project, which is part of the University of Illinois Springfield, and Michael Oppenheimer, who's an attorney with Erickson and Oppenheimer. They both helped secure the release of a Rock Island County man named Nathaniel Onsrud, who they say was wrongly convicted of murdering his own son back in 2008. So, Lauren, how does this case come to the Innocence Process? Maybe Innocence Project, and maybe you can talk a little bit about your process for vetting cases. I imagine you get far more than you actually take up.
Yes. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of innocent people in prisons throughout Illinois. We currently, at the Illinois Innocence Project at the University of Illinois Springfield, represent dozens of people in their innocence claims. And we have, you know, hundreds of requests that come our way a year. The fact is that our prisons really are packed full of innocent people. And I think what's interesting and relates to Nate's case is that many of them pled guilty. You know, I think it seems like, you know, and as Michael just talked about with false confessions, you know, it's counterintuitive to think that an innocent person would confess as something that they didn't do or that they would plead guilty. But in fact, it's quite the opposite. An innocent person is of the mindset that they know that they did not do this. And there's faith in the system that at some point this will be made right and people will learn this and my lawyers will work on my behalf and it will come to light. But the truth is that our system is one that's based around finality and not about truth or justice in the end. And so often these innocent people end up spending decades, if not their lives, in prison. So ordinarily what happens is that an innocent person will write to us and ask us to help them. And we have a very thorough vetting process that we undertake at the Illinois Innocence Project, where individuals fill out a questionnaire. And we have undergraduate students who are part of the University of Illinois Springfield, as well as law students and graduate students at various schools who work with us on evaluating cases. And we have a tremendous staff there and volunteers and people who help us sort of sift through the requests that we get. You know, our project is an interesting one because we're fairly small, but we're small and mighty. And I think part of that is because of our small staff and the limited number of cases we can take, we really push forward on cases once we accept them with our full passion and our full heart, because we know we represent innocent people and we just need to prove it.
Okay. So Michael, can you talk about once this case is taken on, you begin doing the investigative work. Can you talk about your communications with a state's attorney, the prosecutor in Rock Island County? How did that go? How does that go?
Sure. Well, Lauren and I both did this. Lauren had a great part in this. Once we reviewed the case and realized that there was something, for want of a better word, really suspicious here, Lauren and I talked. We reached out to the state's attorney of Rock Island. The current state attorney of Rock Island was great. They agreed to review the case right away because we called because we wanted to get the rest of the file because we didn't know what was in it. They did a really, in this world, light speed, quick review of about a week and a half. They got back to us with information concerning, number one, that they believe that lots and lots of pages of documents, potentially in the thousands, were never turned over to the defense attorney at the time. They also informed us, I don't want to quote them, but they informed us that the state's attorney at that time that was handling the case was fired from their department for withholding documents on other cases. So after we talked to them, after a review, the decision was made by the state's attorney's office to vacate his sentence and vacate the conviction. So normally this process, as Lauren well knows, could take years and years and years and many, many, many court proceedings, and sometimes it never gets done. So the fact that they did that this quick and prompt was great, and I commend them for doing that. And, you know, and they should have done that. This was a gross injustice. In my opinion, this was a criminal act by the people that were involved to essentially frame him. And I commend the state attorney's office for acting so promptly.
You know, can you help me understand? I'm a little unclear on what the posture of the case is now. So the conviction has been vacated, but it's not over yet for Nate, right? There's another court hearing coming up in September. Is it possible he could face a retrial based on what the state's attorney decides to do?
Yes. I don't want to speak too soon. It is possible. Anything's possible. They could review this case. They could decide that they want a retrial. Obviously, we would fight that with everything we have. But I'm hoping, since the state's attorney's office has done the right thing thus far, they have really done the right thing, that the evidence will show. And we still don't have the rest of the file. They've made it available to us. We will have that next week. But I believe that all the evidence will show, number one, that because the state's attorney's office never tendered the other documents, and number two, that Nate is actually innocent. So it's not just they withheld documents. It's he is actually innocent. And I believe they withheld documents showing that he was innocent. But even the evidence that we have thus far through our own research, our own second autopsy, through everything that we've seen, Nate is actually innocent. And I believe and I hope that they will do the right thing. And this part of the case hopefully will be over in early September.
And so, Lauren, I wanted to ask you about that. So the ultimate goal here is to get what I think what's called a certificate of innocence.
Yes.
And Michael, if you wouldn't mind, if I could just ask you to mute your phone. We were getting some background noise. No, that's fine. Thank you. But Lauren, even if people get a certificate of innocence, it's not necessarily an easy path forward for them, right? After being in prison for so long.
Right. I mean, you know, Nate woke up, you know, on Friday morning last week and was given the news that this was coming down the road for him. And, you know, within a matter of days was released from prison after living there for 13 years for something that he didn't do. When he walked out of prison, he walked out only with the property that he had acquired while in prison, which is very little. Anyone in his situation, the clients that we work with who are released walk out to nothing. There's no process through the state that provides them with anything. A certificate of innocence is not guaranteed for everyone. It's another court process, as you noted. And even when you get down, you know, that's months and months down the road, if not longer. And so it ends up falling upon those of us who do this work to step up. And we've found a really incredible community in Springfield who has stepped up to help Nate in this process. But I mean, he's rebuilding his entire life. He went into prison as a 20-year-old grieving father and is coming out as a 33-year-old man needing to rebuild his life with a 13-year gap in his work history and his life history. So there's a lot that needs to be done. There's, you know, so much more that needs to be done by our governments to help innocent people who are released from prison, because it's left up to them to build their lives after they've been taken from them.
Okay. Well, this is a story I'm sure we're going to continue to follow as it continues to play out. And sadly, as you pointed out, there have been hundreds of people found innocent, and I'm sure we will be speaking with you again in the future on another case. Lauren Caseburg is the Chicago Legal Director for the Illinois Innocence Project, which is part of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the University of Illinois Springfield. We've also been speaking with Michael Oppenheimer, who's an attorney with Erickson and Oppenheimer, a civil rights-focused law firm in Chicago. Lauren and Michael, thank you both so much for speaking with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about Illinois-based Quaker Oats Company's decision to pull the Aunt Jemima brand from stores later this year and ultimately replace it with something else. If you have thoughts about this topic, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone lines are open, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Give us a call to talk about not just that brand, but other brands with a legacy of racial stereotypes. That's all coming up on the 21st. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. You've probably had Aunt Jemima branded syrup or pancakes at some point in your life, and you'd probably recognize the depiction of the Aunt Jemima character on the branding that's owned by Illinois-based company Quaker Oats. But do you know the name Nancy Green? She was the real Chicago woman who was originally hired at the 1893 World's Fair to portray Aunt Jemima, and it's her recipe that you've probably enjoyed. Last week, Quaker Oats acknowledged that the Aunt Jemima brand and logo was based on racial stereotypes, having roots in minstrelsy and slavery, and they announced that they'll discontinue the brand. Many critics say the move is long overdue, but there's also a push by some to tell the real story of Nancy Green and ensure that her legacy is honored and preserved. Joining us now is Professor Jason P. Chambers. He's an associate professor of advertising at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, author of the book Madison Avenue and the Color Line, African Americans in the Advertising Industry. Professor Chambers, hello. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And we also have with us Sherry Williams, who's founder and president of the Bronzeville Historical Society, and Marcus Hayes, author and a descendant of Nancy Green, for whom the Aunt Jemima brand was based or named. Sherry and Marcus, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation also. Our lines are open. If you have a question for our guests or want to share your thoughts on Quaker Oats' decision to discontinue the Aunt Jemima branding, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Professor Chambers, I want to begin with you. Can you talk a little bit about what the Aunt Jemima logo, symbol, and brand represent, and specifically why it's problematic?
Well, it's problematic because it's confirmation of and it's perpetuation of a lie. And it's the perpetuation of the lie of the myth of the Old South, the myth of the happy slave, the myth of the African-American female as having enjoyment only in her service to Caucasian Americans. So it's perpetuation of a terrible, terrible lie and a terrible stereotype that's injured both African-Americans and the nation as a whole, because it keeps us from and kept us from really encountering and the complicated story that is the Civil War, and the complicated story, as we've learned recently, the complicated story of race that's still very much, much with us. So that perpetuation of image, even in something as seemingly as innocuous as a pancake mix or a pancake syrup, still has weight, still has meaning. If it had no meaning, there would be no pushback to the change of the name. So it has meaning, and that meaning has been a damaging image to African Americans for the better part of a century.
And, you know, I think another version, I mean, this is called the mammy stereotype, right? People might be familiar with this from the Gone with the Wind or depiction of how the, you know, one of the characters there is portrayed. Is that, that's in the same through line here of history?
It's absolutely in the same vein. The African-American female cook, the heavyset African-American mammy, the mammy figure, if you just think about that and you break it down as the mothering figure. But the mothering figure only is ever shown mothering children who don't look like her, obviously not her own children. She's only shown mothering, if we reduce it to that, only shown mothering cooking for Caucasian families. You don't see her serving African-American children. You don't see her serving even another African-American woman. You don't ever see her eating her own pancakes. I'll go one further. So it's the perpetuation again of that, and an extension of that lie and that mammy stereotype that maybe people are as familiar with from that Gone with the Wind image. That's exactly what we're talking about, as well as the pejorative, the insult, the name. Aunt Jemima, if that very name can be used as an insult to African American women today. So it's a name, it's a character, it's an image that's filled with negative meaning.
Professor, there's a clip that's gone viral this week of a white student speaking at President Trump's rally in Tulsa this past weekend, and I wanted to just play a little bit of that and get your reaction to it.
Aunt Jemima was canceled. And if you didn't know, Nancy Green, the original first Aunt Jemima, she was a picture of the American dream. She was a freed slave who went on to be the face of the pancake syrup that we love and have in our pantries today. She fought for equality, and now the leftist mob is trying to erase her legacy.
So, Professor Chambers, listening to that clip, I wonder, what would you say to those who, you know, say Aunt Jemima is just a branding image, discontinuing it is an example of this, you know, so-called cancel culture?
I would say that they have that latitude. I would say that their privilege gives them the latitude not to care. Right. Well, why should I care about this image? Why should any of us care about this image of an African American on a box of pancake mix or syrup? Well, why should I care? Well, you should care because the people who it's purported to depict care. You should care because it's a pejorative image that has been used of African Americans for over a century, and it's been made innocent by the fact that it's on a box of pancake mix, but it is absolutely still a perpetuation of that negative stereotype that African Americans have fought for years, decades to erase. And here's what I would say to the Quaker Company. If you want to do something, if you want to make it simple, change the name of the pancake mix to Nancy Green's Pancakes and put her image on the box, boom, done, right? Keep it simple. If you want to honor her, do something like that. But what I would say to that young woman is you need to educate yourself and maybe read a book rather than reading things off of a website.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We're discussing Illinois-based Quaker Oats' decision last week to pull the Aunt Jemima brand after acknowledging it was based on racial stereotypes. And we're also looking behind the symbol to Nancy Green, who, as we just heard, who's the Chicago woman who originally was portraying Aunt Jemima at the World's Fair. And we invite you to join the conversation. Do you support Quaker Oats' decision to pull the branding? And are there other racially offensive brands or mascots that you think should be retired? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Sherry Williams founder or president of the Bronzeville Historical Society. I want to bring you into the conversation now. The society's mission, as I understand it, is to preserve and protect African-American history and culture in Chicago. You've done extensive research on the woman behind this brand, Nancy Green. Can you tell us how and when she came to be the symbol that became Aunt Jemima?
Well, I wanted to revisit some of the commentary that Professor made and absolutely understand that images can be injurious. But at this moment, I certainly believe that this is such a teaching moment. Mothers, of course, especially Black mothers, have been figures in Black households and clearly associated with a subservient role when folks kind of examine how Aunt Jemima's image has been perceived. But that clearly is not so for everyone. And so for myself, being a Black woman, a Black mother, a Black grandmother, and being around many women who absolutely wore a bandana or a rag maybe on their heads in order to do this work that was labor intensive, for me, I look at that image in a heroic way because I have some backstory on the life of Nancy Green. And so, you know, I really believe that with this being a teaching moment, that we should examine the fact that Green was a former slave and she would have witnessed the nearly 4 million men and women of African descent being freed. And she would have also witnessed the end of Black codes here in Illinois. She would have witnessed Black men in Chicago who had also been newly freed, exercising their right to vote. And she certainly would have been one of the women who would have cast their vote in Chicago when the 19th Amendment was ratified, giving women the right to vote. And so I clearly believe that the perceptions around the imagery, for me, I believe is quite different because I'm looking at the life of Nancy Green and her experiences and her trials and her triumphs, as opposed to it being an image which is clearly under clearly said by the company, it's a character and it's far from the truth.
And as I understand it, she was hired to portray this character at the World's or the Columbian Exposition, I guess it was called, 1893. Do you think that Nancy Green was taken advantage of?
Well, it's hard to even imagine what her position was when she took on the role, but I certainly admire her as a woman who had clearly understood business savviness. She clearly understood that this was a way to bring income into her household. And I mean, Black women over the centuries have done roles and have done work that might have been considered demeaning or unimportant. And I just really believe that for Nancy Green, this being a source of income, a way that she could bring income into her household, was probably the one idea that she had in taking the role.
Marcus, you're a descendant of Nancy Green, Marcus Hayes. I want to bring you into the conversation. Can you tell us what's your relation to her and who was she, separate from her representation as Aunt Jemima?
Sure. So I am her great nephew. It would be like great to the sixth power nephew.
Yes.
That's who I am. And who she was, I mean, she was a mother, a sister, a niece. She was a woman who made the best out of her situation. She was born into something that she didn't ask for, but made the best out of it. She used what she knew to make sure that her family at the time was taken care of, to provide, while still being looked at as less than human. She was looked at as property. And she still rose to the occasion and made something great out of her life. So she was more than just what we see today. She founded one of the oldest churches in Chicago at Olivet Baptist Church. She used the money that she had for the community. She was a voice for equality. She was way more than what we could ever perceive her to be from a box.
So I wonder, what are your feelings then on Quaker Oats' decision to pull the Aunt Jemima brand, and how would you like her legacy to be preserved?
Yeah, so I kind of agree with the professor a little bit with that I understand that the character in itself has some negative tones to it because of the racism that exists in the United States and probably all over the world. But I also have a heart for her legacy to be told and to be shared. Specifically, I agree that although they try to make this a character, that this is the time when they can actually rectify the situation and say, hey, this was a real person who we took, we have her recipe and she's fed millions. She was a real person. She was just not someone who smiled. She had feelings, emotions. She cared. She was a woman who was passionate about just making it in life. She's a real person. She's just not a character. So for me to easily, I guess one great suggestion, like the professor said, is to acknowledge that Nancy Green is who she is. It's who Aunt Jemima is. Take away the Aunt Jemima, take away the smiling face. I get that. Put Nancy Green on the box. People have benefited from this, from her recipe. People have benefited from her telling her stories while cooking her recipe. Mm-hmm. You know, so do what's right and call it Nancy Green's pancakes, Nancy sure. Green's syrup.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Just a reminder to our listeners, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. And we do have a call now. Mark from Springfield, I understand you think that Quaker Oats is overreacting. Mark, are you there? Okay. I think we lost that caller. Professor Chambers, I wonder, we do hear about that, you know, Quaker Oats is overreacting. What do you, is this just a question of privilege like we heard earlier?
To me it is, because I would simply ask the question, what's the harm, right? If we change the name, if we're not changing the mix, if we're not changing the recipe, if we're not changing the syrup, what is the harm in removing the character? I say, take away the character, take away the name, and absolutely, positively, unequivocally, unquestionably foreground Nancy Green. Put her story, put her picture, put the history of the character and why it was removed. Put that on the box. Put that in your marketing materials. Put that on the labels, right? So take away the character, but keep the person, keep the story. Use that, again, as was said a moment ago, use it as the educational moment that it is. Talk about Black women. Talk about image. You can do all of those things. You can educate while at the same time saying this character that has been so damaging, this type, and it's not just Aunt Jemima, it's been replayed in other films and other products over the years, but this character and this type has meaning, and here's why we took it away, right? And then you can use it to educate people as to why it's not an overreaction, because it's been something that people have been pushing against for decades, for the better part of a century. If it did not matter, it would be an argument that that emerged in society at a point and disappeared and never came back again. But we can look back at history and see time after time after time after time, decade after decade after decade, this brand, this character, this image, not the person, not Nancy Green, but the character, the image being held up by African Americans and saying, stop using us like that. Stop reducing us to just that. Expand the image of us. Are there Black women who look like that, who act like that, who do those things, who wear clothes like that? Absolutely. But for that to be the only image of us that exists in media and communications, that's just plain wrong, right? It's just plain wrong. And if it did not matter, trust me, we wouldn't have cared for as long as we have.
Yeah. I'd like to continue this conversation after a short break here. So if you can all stick around, we have been speaking with Professor Jason Chambers, a professor of advertising at the University of Illinois, author of the book Madison Avenue and the Color Line, African-Americans in the Advertising Industry. Also Sherry Williams, founder and president of the Bronzeville Historical Society, and Marcus Hayes, who is a descendant of Nancy Green, the woman on whom the Aunt Jemima brand was based. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. I want to remind our listeners, you can always join in, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Stay with us, more to come on this conversation after a short break. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to continue our conversation about the Illinois-based Quaker Oats' company decision to pull Aunt Jemima syrup and pancake branding and replace it with something else to be determined. We've also been talking about Nancy Green, the real-life Chicago woman who was the basis for that character, was hired to portray that character at the Columbian Exposition, the World's Fair in Chicago in the late 1800s. And Sherry, we've been speaking with, I should say, Sherry Williams, founder and president of the Bronzeville Historical Society, also Professor Jason Chambers from the University of Illinois, and Marcus Hayes, who's a descendant of Nancy Green. And Sherry Williams, I understand you're pushing for Nancy Green's resting place, which is currently an unmarked grave, to be given a headstone. Can you talk about why that's important?
Yes. Certainly, in the scheme of Chicago's role for the period of the Civil War, we found our organization looking more deeply as to whom would have been around in Chicago prior to the Civil War and some 50 years after. And this is how I began really taking a look at those who are interned at Oakwood Cemetery. And we noticed immediately that through using Ancestry.com and also Find a Grave and other online tools, that many people were at least sharing publicly some of those whom they felt needed recognition beyond what they might have shared online. And one of those individuals whom stood out prominently was certainly Nancy Green. And so I would imagine probably close to 15 years ago, when we first started doing Underground Railroad tours, they were centered around residents in Chicago whom had some notes about their participation as Civil War soldiers and U.S. colored troops, and also their role as abolitionists and those who were aiding those who came here as freedom seekers. And so Nancy Green kept coming to the surface over and over again, and we thought collectively as community, we need to have her grave marked in a meaningful way. And so as painful as these histories are around enslavement and many untold stories for the Quaker Oats Company, you know, simply removing the Aunt Jemima name and as a brand or the image does not erase or make disappear these painful experiences. So we have to date already raised more than $5,000 to put a marker on Mrs. Nancy Green's gravesite. We are certainly looking for more contributions to come in to make certain that the marker is suiting that of her role as a freedom seeker, a woman whom had been enslaved, and a woman who, of course, left a legacy with the Aunt Jemima brand.
And we got a caller, not on the air, but who called in to say, Dory from DeKalb says that Quakers were abolitionists and should not support the Aunt Jemima brand. Dory identifies as a Quaker, but she thinks Nancy Green should be honored for who she was and the experiences she went through, not necessarily Aunt Jemima. Marcus, I wonder, when the decision was made to discontinue Aunt Jemima, Pepsi Company, which owns Quaker Oats, announced it would begin a $400 million initiative to, quote, lift up Black communities and increase Black representation at Pepsi, close quote. And Marcus, my question for you, I guess, was Nancy Green compensated fairly for the branding of Aunt Jemima?
Thank you for bringing that up. I do not believe so. In fact, to this day, her descendants do not receive, we have not received any compensation from Quaker Oats or PepsiCo. In fact, the decision to change Ancient Mama, if you will, to take it off the shelves, we have not been in conversation with Quaker Oats or PepsiCo on how we felt or, you know, what can we do? And then for them to come up with this reparations, if you will, act to over the next 5 years to give $400 million to different outlets without addressing the families of people of the brand Ancient Mama, the ladies and the women who came even after my great aunt, is distasteful that they did not even reach out and say, hey, this is what's happening. I know that you are descendant. We want to make our wrongs right, and we want to make sure that the family is in agreement and how we move about. We move forward. There's nothing left for the family. To put it in context, the people who have benefited from Quaker Oats and PepsiCo, their great great nephew to the sixth power, like I am, is taken care of. Matter of fact, their children is taken care of, their unborn children. Yet the families of Nancy Green and the ladies that came after her, we're left with nothing. To give you even more context, I didn't understand my lineage of who my ancestors were until last year. Nancy Green, my father died when I was 3 years old. So his side of the family, I did not know. And thanks to Sherry, who is persistent about pursuing this, did a genealogy test and was able to track it back to me. Now I'm sitting here with a loss of sense of who I am, and come to find out my ancestor has done something so monumental that millions of people and billions of dollars have been given in, you know, off of what she's done. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's so distasteful that we haven't even had a conversation with them, that they won't even acknowledge us. It's hard to believe that we're living in a day and a time like this where people can benefit and take advantage of your ancestors and you still feel the effect 100 years later.
Yeah. Well, we need to wrap the conversation very soon, but just really briefly, Professor Chambers, I want to end with you. It seems the Aunt Jemima brand is on her way out, but there's still professional football team in Washington, D.C., baseball team in Cleveland that are based on offensive Native American stereotypes, not to mention high school and college teams. Do you think we're at a moment of reckoning with racially problematic brands and mascots? And briefly, what do you hope to see?
Well, I do think we're at a reckoning, and I hope to see this moment be used for its educational value, certainly on Nancy Green and her history, her story, and on the family, but also the impact of these stereotypical, derogatory, or at a minimum, racially insensitive names. And why can't we as a nation just here in 2020 say, is this a complicated discussion? Absolutely. Is it a challenging discussion? Is it an economic discussion? Does it have economic ramifications and impact? Sure. But why can't we as a nation say, let's just move forward past the easy ones, right? Let's move forward past the name of the team in Washington. Let's move forward past the name of the baseball team in Cleveland. Let's move forward past the name of a football team in Florida. All of those things. Let's just, you know, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, no pun intended, to the Billie Holiday song, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, that we can just move past those things and then move on to the ever more complicated parts of the discussion about race, about naming, about economic impact, about compensation for descendants and family members, which I 100% think should happen. Then let us move forward from here. Use this teaching moment to move forward from here.
We're going to have to leave it there. Our guests have been Professor Jason Chambers, Associate Professor of Advertising at the University of Illinois, author of the book Madison Avenue and the Color Line, African Americans in the Advertising Industry, as well as Sherry Williams, founder and president of the Bronzeville Historical Society, and Marcus Hayes, an author and a descendant of Nancy Green. Professor Chambers, Sherry, Marcus, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
The Illinois Farm Bureau is more than one of more than a dozen groups working on protecting monarch butterflies and their habitats. The organization is working with farmers to change mowing practices, plant pollinator habitats, and to closely monitor pesticides as part of their conservation efforts. For more on this, I'm joined now by Lauren Lurkins. She's Director of Environmental Policy for the Illinois Farm Bureau. And also with us is Evan Holteen. He's the Farm Bureau President for Bureau County. That's about an hour north of Peoria. Lauren and Evan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.
So it's going to be sort of a shorter conversation. Sorry, the last one went a little long. But I wonder, Lauren, for someone who might not know, what role do pollinators play in our food system and our overall ecosystem? Why are they important?
Yeah, so lately in the agricultural space, we've been talking about the monarch butterfly as well as pollinators in general. And we in ag, we support sort of that diversity out on the countryside, wanting our row crop and different facets of agriculture to coexist with pollinators and habitats. And I think Evan might be able to speak more directly about the benefit that pollinators can play, but we need pollinators to help pollinate many of the foods that we grow across the state and the food that we eat. And we also think that our row crop agriculture in the state can actually serve as a place where we can and have, in fact, add additional habitat to support a variety of species.
All right. So how about that, Evan? Can you tell us more about some of the changes you've made to your farm to support pollinator populations? What do these conservation efforts look like and why are they important?
Yeah, certainly. So a few years ago, we added a pollinator habitat on our farm just as a way to try to redirect some of those pollinator species to be a little more prevalent in the area for our fruit trees and our raspberry bushes. And I think, you know, with the fact that there's so many commodities grown in Illinois that don't require pollinators, that sometimes it's easy to maybe lose sight a little bit about their value to some of the commodity crops. But we have such a diverse degree of agriculture in the state. And so when row crop farmers have these kind of niche areas that are a good fit for some of these pollinator habitats, it just increases the kind of refuge space and the activity of the monarch butterflies and bees and any other pollinator, you know, within our state, and makes them a little more available to the farmers and growers that need them for fruit trees or vegetable crops and whatever mm-hmm. else we might be growing.
And what does a, just briefly, and maybe just a few seconds, what take us there? What does a pollinator habitat look like?
So it's just an area designated for native flowering plants that are pollen sources for bees or milkweed for the monarch, for example, that just a safe space to grow those specific plants required for those species.
So you kind of regionally draw the insects in, sort of a micro region to this area, in the hopes that they spread out into the surrounding agricultural areas to do their business. Lauren, what role has agriculture played? And unfortunately, we are running out of time here, but what role has agriculture played? And do you hope it will continue to play in helping to stabilize these populations?
Yeah, and we could go on and on and on, but the work here in the state actually dates back a number of years until about 2014. And what we just recently did at the end of May at Illinois Farm Bureau, we worked with nonprofits and our agencies across the state, as well as agribusiness, and we really pulled together the metrics at the amount of habitat that's gone into the state to support the monarch butterfly and pollinators more generally. And in fact, we're looking at close to 1 million different acres put into different federal or state conservation programs to support pollinators, as well as over $100,000 of research support right here in our state, and gobs of education and outreach from everybody. So we're very excited that the Illinois agricultural sector can play an important role. What we did was we took those metrics and we actually submitted them to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so that they can rely on that data when they start to make decisions on whether, in fact, the monarch butterfly should be listed as an endangered species.
Hmm. Well, this is an interesting subject, and unfortunately, that's all the time we have to talk about it. We will tweet out some more information about this if people want to learn more. Lauren Lerkins is Illinois Farm Bureau Director of Environmental Policy. We've also been speaking with Bureau County Farmer Evan Holteen. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go, we want to bid a fond farewell to Libby Foster, who started on the 21st as an intern and at this point is our longest serving producer on the show. I've had the privilege of working with Libby on some of my favorite segments, like my interview with author Dave Eggers, and she brought a sharp eye for stories and a thoughtful approach to shaping interviews. Libby, we wish you all the best in the next phase of your career and know that you will be sorely missed. Our program is also produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan's our engagement producer. Intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft. This is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.